I grind my bottom lip between my teeth. I'm guessing she wasn't a bedwetter. Flipping ahead through the pages, most everything else is about my birth. Something called an Apgar score. A copy of my tiny inky footprints. PKU results. When and how I breastfed. Baby's first pee and poo. Yikes, it's thorough. There's a note at the very bottom of the last page that catches my eye. Patient is bonding with infant. I put the papers away and close the folder gently, then pull my legs up and hug my knees, breathing in and out. So? Jessa clears her throat. Are you okay? Nodding, I breathe in and out and in. Maybe I shouldn't be okay. The information is somewhat ominous, but honestly, it explains a lot. It's like I've been driving through fog and rain, and now the weather is starting to clear. The road just ahead of me sharpening, coming into focus. Before tonight, I had only my dad's word to go on, my bedtime story, and of course I trust him. But here's real evidence that my mother was sick, that she needed saving, and whether or not Lindy wants to believe, I'm starting to get why my dad is searching for her. This is good, I say to myself and to Jessa. This helps. Awesome! So where do we start? No offense, but I think I want to just do it by myself, you know? But thanks, I finish lamely. She snorts. Okay. Except maybe you should have figured that out before you, like, drag me to the hospital. I didn't, I start to protest. Oh, whatever! She jumps off the bed and plops dramatically down on a nest of leggings in her lips chair, arms slicing the air. You think I'm an idiot, right? Jeez, sorry I didn't get 2230 on my SATs. But you're not as smart as you think, because I know you lied about your dad. You're lying to the police and Lindy, and I know you lied to my mom. You lied to me about shopping, and you lied about your car being in the shop all weekend, because I saw it at your house just now when we drove by. Oh, most brilliant genius. Don't deny it. I'm a way better liar than you. You could have gone to the hospital by yourself. You decided you needed me. But what? You don't trust me? The rough edges of the stone saw into my fingers. So what if I lied? I'm the one that has to find him. By you, you mean the cops, yes?
Yeah, right. They don't know my dad.
Jessa's bright blue eyes are so wide, they're almost floating. I'm not trying to be a bitch, Im. But he never told you anything about your mom, and he didn't tell you he was peacing out. And he hasn't told you where he is, so maybe you don't know him either. He did tell me, I say, shoving the file into my bag and tumbling the heart in after it. He's looking for my mother. My real mom, I mean. I think he's trying to help her. But why now? After this long? I haven't figured that out, but if I can find her, I'll find him. I never should have come to the Prices. I stand to leave, to walk home and slip in the back and sneak to my bedroom, where I can lock myself in alone, like I wanted from the start. Okay, okay, okay. Wait. Jessa vaults up and into my path. I start to slink around her and she blocks me. I fake right, but she spreads her arms and beats me to the left. If you really think that's where your dad is, I can help. And I am a better liar than you. I hover between the bed and the door. Why do you even want to help? Isn't that what best friends do? I pause because honestly, I don't know. It seems true. I sigh and drop the bag, if not my doubts. I guess. Great. And anyway, she shrugs and twirls a strand of hair. It's February break. There's nothing else to do, except Mackenzie Wynn's party. Wait, what party? At Mackenzie's. Next Saturday? No one told me about a party, I say, a little hurt. I'm in mock trial with Mackenzie. Jessa purses her lips, has the grace to look guilty. I was going to.
7. I wake the next morning with a shirtless vampire eye-sexing me, puzzling when I'm still dragging myself out of my dream by my fingertips. In the dream, I was driving down a road striped with power lines and stippled with leaf light through the trees. It was peaceful until I came raging through, swerving and clipping the guardrail like I was drunk. That dizzy feeling I remember from the night Lee Jung and I hijacked his parents' Goldschlager. But in the dream I was clear-headed, just unable to control the car, or my foot like a 50-pound weight on the gas, or the spasming steering wheel. I knew there was somewhere I needed to be, something I needed to get to, and might if only I could drive in a straight line. Maybe my dreams are trying to tell me something. It's a short, muddled moment before the whys and the wheres coming floating back out of the fog. I'm in Jess's bed, smashed against the big Vampire Diaries poster tacked to her bedroom wall. I'm here and not in my own bed because Dad is missing, has been missing for 4 days. As I realize this, an ache settles in my chest. Not a weight, but an absence, a pocket of nothingness inside me. Then I roll over and see Jessa drooling on her floral pillowcase, uncharacteristically rumpled. Weirdly, I feel shy, remembering the night before, my tantrum, and afterward in the quiet bedroom, the sounds of her breathing so close to me when we turned the lights out. It was nice having a friend there in the dark while I pieced together an imperfect picture of my mother. My mother bonded with me at birth. My mother was once an assistant to the curator of prints and drawings at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. My mother wasn't even 21 when she gave birth to me. My mother was taking pills for major depression. My mother has a cousin. I remember our project for the day and sit up with a start. I catapult off the mattress, careful not to catch a foot on my friend. She curls into the sheets. Ugh, she groans. What are you doing? We have an emergency contact to find. It's Sunday. It's 7 o'clock. On a Sunday. I can't sleep anymore. You could if you tried. I even gave you the Damon Salvatore side of the bed. What a waste. She jabs her finger at the fanged blonde on the poster. Rolling, she reaches out and caresses his pale paper face. Good morning, lover. What does Jeremy think of the Damon Salvatore side of the bed? She sits up and half smiles, arches her back, cat-like. He wouldn't give a shit if it was a Yankees poster. I have a bed and a door that locks. What a prince. I squat and dig through her pants drawer, hoping for something, anything, in a size bigger than 2. Taking Jess's help? It's difficult. Taking her pants? Not a problem. Oh, whatever. I'm, like, 17. I choose not to ponder the fact that although I'm also 17, the highlight of my sex life has been a few heavy breathing and pants-rubbing sessions in Lee Jung's TV room, while Reservoir Dogs played and shouted and bled on the big screen, and my head fizzed with the Goldschlager. Jessa watches me root through her pants. I take it you're not going home. I stiffen. I can go home. If you're busy or something, you know that's not what I'm saying. Here. She takes mercy on me and tosses me a pair of black leggings with zippered ankles draped across the headboard. I lift them tentatively. They're totally clean. And slimming. Oh gosh, thanks. With this. Jessa leaps up and plunges into her vaulted closet, emerging with a slouchy red sweater dress, a big black heart glittering across the back. And this. She thrusts a necklace at me, a long black chain with little gold charms and red beads and doodly bobs jingling on the end. I have to admit it's a cool ensemble. But this seems like a strange day for dress-up. Maybe sensing this, she shrugs. If you think you look good, you'll be more confident and stuff. Who am I to argue? It works for Jessa. I take my bounty and my purse and leave Jessa alone with Damon Salvatore. Darting down the hall so I won't be caught by Chad with happy cupcakes on my breasts, I shut myself in the bathroom. Strange day for dress-up, though it may be. I pull and clasp and stuff myself into Jess's outfit like it's armor.
I brush my hair into a careful, sleek ponytail, swipe on some not particularly daring brown eyeliner I found rolling around my purse bottom, and stare myself down in the mirror. Embarrassed by last night's cowardice, I tell myself that for the next 24 hours, I am an unstoppably brilliant badass detective. I'm Emily Polifax, Lisbeth Salander, Annika Bengtsson. I'm Miles fucking Fay. When I get back to the bedroom, Jess is still under the covers, but zipping a finger across her iPad screen like the professional she is. Neither of us could find a Sidoni Fay online, because of course it wouldn't be so easy so soon. But hers isn't the only name I've got. Officer Griffin and the police will be talking to Dad's limited family, a fistful of cousins scattered across the West Coast, an uncle in Chicago, Grandpa Scott in a nursing home for Alzheimer's patients, for what that's worth. But I have my mother's family. Okay, so there's a few Lillian Wards on Facebook, Jessa says. But I don't think they're the right ages. Huh. What's that 978 area code? Tap, tap, swipe. Shrewsbury. That's like half an hour southwest, right? Swipe, tap, tap, type. While she works, she chews the inside of her lip, a familiar and almost unattractive tic that only escapes when she's concentrating too hard to worry about looking unattractive. Okay, nothing about her in the white pages, but here's something else for Lillian Eugene, maiden name Lillian Ward. She tilts the screen toward me. What's Intelux? It's one of those professional background check sites Mrs. Ginsburg told us about in global communications class. Companies can pay to look up the dirt on employees before hiring them. Property records, criminal history, social media search. This is just the stuff we can see without paying. Wow. Can you try Sidoni Fay? It's a long shot. If her name were on this site, it would have turned up in a search. As expected, nothing. Maybe it just means no companies have done a background check on her in a while. I sit on the bed beside her and gobble up what crumbs of info there are. Relatives, Michael Ward, Elizabeth Ward. Married name, Lillian Eugene. Address history, Fitchburg, Massachusetts, Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, Worcester, Massachusetts. Worcester is just one town farther than Shrewsbury. Look for Lillian Eugene on Facebook and see if there are any of them in Worcester. One sec. Okay, ta-da! Here's one in Worcester. And geez, she frowns. She only has 13 friends, poor lady. I take the iPad. Lillian Eugene's account looks like the kind a grown-up sets up for the sole purpose of playing Candy Crush. There are regular status updates, totally factual statements like, what a hot day it is today. Went to see a movie last night and liked it very much. And the last, spring cleaning my classroom. Work on a Sunday morning is not much fun. She has 13 friends indeed and almost no comments. Talk about shouting into the void. None of these friends are Sidoni anything, or anybody Fay. I open her photos page to find exactly one picture, her profile, a close-up of her face. Middle-aged, with very short, wispy hair, more ashen than blonde, and webs of wrinkles in the corners of her colorless gray eyes. Is it her? Jessa plunks a finger down on Lillian Eugene's face. I can't tell. I hold the screen closer, searching for a trace of me and her. It's a hard sell. I look a lot like my dad, who inherited his facial features and dark, straight hair from my Chinese grandmother, then passed a weaker strain on to me. We have the same brown eyes and thin noses and natural frowns. But maybe there's something in Lillian's round cheeks and narrow chin, a heart-shaped face, like Mom's in her picture in A Time to Chill, like mine. Dad doesn't have one for sure. It could be. I mean, it might. What is she, your aunt? Second cousin. Okay, so send her a message. I float my finger over the screen, hesitating. It just doesn't seem right. In Nancy Drew's day, she had to worry whether suspicious Taylor Sinclair would spot the beam of her flashlight as she followed him through the mysterious Mayan exhibit at the museum. Now, I have to worry whether to tip off my second cousin that I'm Facebook stalking her. I don't know. Think about it. My morning breath is distracting me. While Jessa goes and washes up in the bathroom and does what she does to pop out looking like America's Next Top Model, I sit cocooned in her flowered quilt, trying to make her iPad do my bidding. I might be the only kid in the school district who doesn't know how to use one. A few birthdays ago, I complained to Dad, but he just patted me on the head and said, "Suffering helps the soul to grow." Flicking clumsily through Lillian's profile, I bring up her contact info. There's no phone number, but in the employment section, it lists St. Augustine High in Worcester. I check her status update about spring cleaning and see that it was posted less than an hour ago. As I'm banging on the bathroom door, Jessa emerges, face dripping and hair piled atop her head with a big claw clip. "Jesus! What? How fast can you be ready to go?" She looks in the mirror, does some mental math. "Half hour? Can you do like 10 minutes? She twists her lips. "I can do 17. "Sold." Jessa keeps her word, and an hour later we're navigating the uncharming streets of Worcester, Massachusetts, in my Civic, which we rescued from my driveway in a stealth operation, by which I mean we ran through the wind to my house, hopped in, shut the car door softly, and peeled out of there before Lindy could peek through the curtains. I'll have to face her sometime today, but who knows how long it will take Lily and Eugene to clean out her classroom. "Turn right at the gas station." Jessa points toward a street just past a Sunoco. She sort of knows Worcester. She was carted down by her family a few times a year for Chad's high school soccer matches against Burncoat High and Claremont Academy. But she's never seen St. Augustine, a stone megalith that looms over the corner of Elm. Round towers like castle turrets, narrow slots for windows, a big marble statue of a robed saint feeding a deer in the courtyard. "Oh, good." Jessa frowns as I park in the lot around back. "We're breaking into Jesus school." "We're not breaking in," I say, surveying the lot. There's a little green car across the way, speckled gray with mud and dust. "We're scoping out." "Is that hers, you think?" Jessa nods her chin at the car. "It's the only car here. What if she went home?" "Then we'll ask whoever it is about her. Obviously they work here." "So, we scope?" "We scope." The wind whips our hair as we step outside into the weather, growing steadily darker and more miserable. The clouds are a solid gray block above us, low-hanging, and the ice in the air burns my nostrils on the inhale. Wednesday's warm snap has definitely passed. I duck down inside my puffy coat, wishing I hadn't put on such thin armor, wishing I had a tissue, wishing, most of all, that I could be the kind of detective unfazed by problems so petty as cold legs and a runny nose. We book it to the grimy car across the lot. Jessa tucks her fingers into her jacket sleeve and reaches to wipe the frost off the passenger side window. "Wait," I say. "There might be an alarm." "Please, it's a Saturn SL. She clears the glass. "I see a cat bobblehead on the dashboard," she says through chattering teeth. "Does that help?" "Yes, immensely." I peek in through the driver's side window. Empty except for a coffee thermos in the cup holder and a few Petco bags full of cleaning supplies on the gray cloth seats. I don't know what I expected to find. Jessa tugs on the driver's side door handle. "Whoa, felon." "Oh, it's locked anyway. So now what?" "We wait for someone to come out, I guess." We retreat to the Civic, and I turn the key so heat leaks out of the vents. While we wait, I sneak a look at Jessa, gorgeously flushed in the cold. Her abbreviated prep time hasn't done her any harm. What would I do with all that beauty if it were mine? What would I worry about if I had perfect skin and expertly shaped nails and a miniature nose and a perfect house and a brilliant mother and a normal father whose only shortcoming was sinking a little too deeply into his boring work stories at the dinner table? I know Jessa must have her own problems, the most often spoken of being true love. She loves Jeremy, then she loves Levy Cantu, then she loves Mike Wazkowitz. Then she's letting Jeremy unhook her bra in his dorm room at BU and loving him more than anything. Maybe that's what comes of having the perfect life. You've got nothing to do with your time but love everybody just that much. When I think of it that way, it sounds like a problem I don't ever want. An hour later, the side exit of St. Augustine swings open, and a squat woman wobbles out onto the grassy moat around the school, then into the parking lot, her head so far down in the wind that she's practically tipped forward.
Hey, hey!
Jessa, preoccupied with Fruit Ninja after growing bored by our stakeout, has looked up from her phone and elbows me unnecessarily.
Yeah, I see her.
I shoulder open my door and without a moment's hesitation call out, Hi, excuse me, are you Lily and Eugene by any chance? The woman slows, then continues forward. Close up, I can see she's a small woman, the pom-pom perched on her winter hat no higher than my chin, swaddled in a bulky winter jacket that gives her the figure of the Michelin Man. A scarf is wrapped around the lower half of her face, but her eyes peek out, gray like sky overcast by filmy clouds. They wince suspiciously.
Are you a student? She mumbles through her scarf. No students allowed in the lot on Sundays.
I feel the panic swell up inside me until I remember that I'm Miles Fay, and I'm bulletproof. Do you know a Sidoni Fay?
The scarf drops, revealing the hard line of her puckered lips. She swipes a stray hair out of her face gracelessly.
Do you?
I swallow. I wish. 8.
2 blocks from St. Augustine, my second cousin lives in a faded brick apartment building gridded with rust-stained balconies. On the inside, it's clean enough, though there are no elevators. The hallways are cold and dim, and a damp locker room smell seeps up from the tangerine carpet. Lillian Eugene leads the way up 5 flights of stairs to apartment 54B. Settling her bag on one hip, she jiggles her key in the lock, opens the door a sliver, and sticks a boot inside before threading the rest of her body through.
Come quick, before the babies escape.
Jessa and I slip into the front hallway, where we're pinned by the yellow moon eyes of 5 gigantic gray cats.
Did my babies miss me? Did they miss me very much?
Lillian coos as the cats rub their faces on her snow boots and melt between her legs.
Was Mama gone forever and ever? Did you miss Mama? You did.
Somehow she makes it to the closet without trampling a tail or a paw. I've forgotten Jessa until she leans in and whispers,
What's that word that means a vision?
What?
I whisper back.
Like, say I just had a vision of tomorrow's front page headline, Teenage girls fed poisoned butterscotches in Worcester apartment, beautiful faces eaten by cats. What would you call that?
A premonition. And stop. I shrug her off. Thanks for having me up here, Ms. Eugene.
Call me Lil, but I can't talk too long. Just popping in to feed the babies, and then I'm running out.
She strips out of her heavy winter coat. Underneath, she's a sharp, thin woman, nearly as colorless as her pets. Her short gray hair is a static halo around her face. She rolls up the sleeves of her shapeless gray sweater and studies me, and it strikes me that Lillian Eugene is not delighted by my presence.
You look like your father,
she says matter-of-factly. Her eyes flick down to my chin, like my mother's, like Lil's. She smiles in a strained kind of way.
Yes, I think so, too.
We sit at the little plastic-topped kitchen table while she prepares the cat's food. To our left is a window that looks out into a multi-story parking garage, and on the sill, a little ceramic planter that must have held something green and alive once, but now it's an empty socket,
the soil inside filmed with dust. I squint in the headlights of a car as it parks directly across from us, its front bumper maybe 10 feet from our chairs.
"So this is a cute place," Jessa manages.
I shiver, noticing just now how cold it is in Lil's apartment.
"We get by here. Close to school and enough room for me and my babies."
She sets 5 bowls down on the floor and the cats cease their whining, attacking their food as one. Satisfied, Lil backs up against the counter. Jessa and I occupy the only 2 chairs in the kitchen, one of which Lil dragged in from another room.
"So, how'd you look me up?" she asks.
"Some old paperwork, stuff my dad left lying around."
"He knows you're here?"
"No one knows. I keep it vague. I don't yet have a reason to lie to my long-lost relative, but you never know when a reason will present itself."
"You two haven't talked in a while?"
"What, me and your dad? Jesus, no." Lil plucks a piece of gray hair off her sweater. Hers or her baby's, I can't tell.
"Not in forever. We fell out of touch. I fell out of touch with a lot of people after my divorce. That's the way it happens."
I don't know what to say to this. Should you apologize for hearing someone's ancient bad news when by now they must be sick to death after years of hearing I'm sorry?
"I guess Dad doesn't really keep in touch with most of Mom's family."
"No, he hasn't had much contact with us since your mama. Not that there are many of us left." I can't help but deflate a little. I'd hoped Dad and I were sniffing along the exact same trail, but that doesn't mean there isn't a trail here. No one else can tell me what this woman can. No one else can tell me about her. Except my dad. And where is he? I fiddle with the charms on my borrowed necklace, fold my hands in my lap, crack my knuckles.
Who is left, then?
Not Sid's parents. My parents moved down south for the heat, and they won't be coming back. Can't say I blame them.
Lil stoops, and with a huff of pain, clumsily lowers her narrow body to the floor to sit among her cats who drip over her like honey.
Do you want my chair? Jessa asks, red-faced, stroking her fingers through her hair furiously.
I can wait somewhere else.
Oh, no. Lil shakes her head, smiling down on her pets. I like it fine right here. What's good enough for my babies is good enough for me.
Jessa returns to staring nervously out the window into the parking garage, bouncing her leg under the table and chewing the inside of her lip.
Is there any more of Mom's family around here? I ask, trying to steer us straight.
I'd love to meet them. Dad never really talks about you all. Or, you know, my mom.
Do you ever talk to her?
Sid?
Lord, no. Not in years and years.
How many would you say?
I guess 5 or 6. The last time we talked, I was still with Robert, but near the end. I remember because he came down to my reading room in the old place, which he never came into, and said, "It's one of your cousins on the phone for you." And I said, "I only have the one." And he said, "Yes, but didn't she run off?"
What did she say to you?
She wasn't saying too much.
Sid and me were close once, when we were little, in Fitchburg. I live near the part I guess they don't call Tar Hill anymore, but they used to. Her mama was my daddy's sister. We were only kids, no other cousins around. I think there were more of our people out west, more wards, but we never met them. I don't know about her daddy's side. Anyhow, her mom went off when Sid was young, and her daddy passed on when she was in high school, so Sid came and lived with us. Her daddy left a little insurance money for her, so when she graduated, she took it and left to, what do you call it, study abroad at a fancy art school in some country over there.
Switzerland? I ask, recalling my bedtime story.
I think Sweden. Whichever, she left, and I never heard a peep from her.
Don't think she meant to come back till Siobhan died.
That's her grandmother.
How did she die?
Lil looks up at me and her eyes narrow.
Exposure, I guess. Sleeping outside in the cold. Wouldn't your daddy know this?
I just...
I thought I remembered him saying it was her heart. She shrugs. So she called you 5 years ago and said that she just left her job. She was a receptionist for some eye doctor's office. I don't know the name of it. Lion? Something like Lion. Anyway, she wasn't there anymore and she needed some money. Wanted to know if me or Robert could wire it to a Western Union in Connecticut. I sent what I could. Where in Connecticut? I don't remember that. Lil's eyes flicker to the clock ticking above the rusted stove. I know what you're asking, and I don't know where she is. Imogene. Right. I can't tell you where she is. Don't know who could. It's been too long, and the family isn't around anymore. Some moved away. Most passed. Defeated, I go to the next question on my list. What was she like when you did know her? She was shy when we were kids. Okay in school. She was good at art. Drawing. She loved those how-to draw books. Animals, faces, fantasy stuff. She had one with her all the time. Sometimes we would camp out in one of our little backyards, you know? There wasn't any forest or anything behind our houses, just a yard. We'd sleep in this old army surplus tent of my father's, and Sid would spend the whole night drawing. Oh, I don't know. Trolls? Or unicorns? She always wanted to be an artist. Another difference between us. I can barely draw a stick, gallows, and hangman. I guess that's why she went to art school. She never finished, though. Whatever she did at the museum, it wasn't something you needed a degree for. Not back then. Now they say you need one to wash dishes. Something sinuous wraps around my leg. I look down to discover one of the cats and resist the urge to kick it away. Why didn't she finish school? Sid met your daddy. Had you. And then... Lil sighs deeply. I talked to Sid the night she left you both, you know. Jessa is trying to catch my gaze, but I avoid her. She feels sorry for me. Well, she shouldn't. Because right now it isn't even me talking to Lil Eugene. It's Miles Fay with one goal, to get to the bottom of this mystery and find my dad. I make that the stone truth and harden myself around it. What did she... Did she tell you why? Her lips screw up into a tremulous line. There was no good why. She was troubled waters, like her mother. Siobhan was troubled waters, too. That's what my own mama called her. Sid said your daddy would be better off. You would be better off. Everyone would be better off. But I don't think anybody was ever better off for what that girl did. The clock ticks away the silence while a cat with what might be a sinus condition jockeys for position in Lil's lap, wheezing and purring in turns. She stares into its snot-streaked face, and who knows what she sees there, but her voice is duller and distant when she speaks again. Well, I really got to be running out now. Unexpectedly, Jessa leans across the table. Im is your cousin and you just met her. Can't you stay for a while? Lil levers herself stiffly off the floor, shedding animals from her lap as she rises. It's my doctor's appointment. Not supposed to be late, but I have some pictures and things if you want to take them with you. That would be great. Anything you can give me. And maybe your number so I can call you sometime? I'll leave mine in case you remember anything. She hesitates in the kitchen doorway. Just hold on a minute. With a last look, she ducks into the hallway. I jump as Jessa slaps her hand over mine. Okay, she's weird, Im. I mean, like, I know teachers are weird. I had Mrs. Marconi in sophomore year, and she had, like, a deli in her desk. Not chips or breath mints or anything. Lunch meat, pickles, huge bottles of Pepsi in the bottom drawer. But your second cousin... is unusual. Maybe it's the curse, I say, fingering the stone in my pocket as I watch the biggest of the cats mount the kitchen counter, flop backward, and lick the dark fur between its legs. What curse? I shrug. Lil makes her way back into the kitchen with a small stack of photos and time-rippled papers in her hands. Here's all I got. That's my number on that sticky note, but it's a home phone. I don't see much need to carry a little phone around all the time. If I wanted to talk to anybody, I'd call, and I usually don't want to talk. Greedily, I flip through the pictures. There's a fuzzy baby photo in the pile, a little bald, hazel-eyed girl wriggling on a patchwork quilt, her oversized head tilted toward the camera with great effort. In Dad's office, there's a picture of me just like this. I may be a few months old, wallowing on a blue shag rug strewn with soft, plasticized baby books, my enormous skull wobbling so precariously that even though it's a moment frozen on film, you could swear I'm about to faceplant into Goodnight Moon. Dad insists, book, was my first word, though sometimes Lindy swears the first words out of my mouth must have been, I'm fine, I don't need any help, go away. Next is a picture of two little girls, the younger in brown pigtails, the older one a dirty shade of blonde. Mom and Lil stand on the lawn of a church. Lil surprises me by tapping the picture with a fingernail bitten down to the skin. That's the church we used to walk to each week, and our mamas would let me and Sid take the long way around Crocker Field on the way to Sid's house for Sunday lunch. I swear you could hear the crack of the baseball bats from her backyard. Smell the hot dogs. I nod, wondering what goes on in Sunday school. Dad and I are not church people, though I've been in one for Mama Scott's funeral. In the next picture, Mom is still small, but alone by a wiry forked birch tree in a front yard, the sky behind the little house awash in the yellow light of bad weather. Chain-link borders the scrappy yard, my mother's childhood home. I flip to a Polaroid of teenage Sidoni in a very early 90s prom dress in front of a tall brick building with Fitchburg High School, home of the Red Raiders, emblazoned on a sign. Her dress is long and straight and silvery, with a ruffled bit draped over her breasts like a curtain valance. Her date stands behind her, a tall black teenager with the kind of high pillar of hair I recognize from 90s TV shows. The tip of her head comes up only to the padded shoulders of his navy suit. Even though she's awkward in the picture, elbows away from her body, pink lipstick smile showing all the wrong teeth, he looks thrilled to be with her. His grin is huge, and his hand rests lightly on her arm. Like if he couldn't touch her, he wouldn't believe his luck. The last and latest is Mom, pregnant in the shade of a birch tree, in front of a gray stone fountain I recognize from the Patty Linden Memorial Park in Sugarbrook. Clutching the photos, I want to say, great, this helps. Here's my number and thanks for your time. I'll make my way out of this dim apartment, which is weird. Pickles in your desk drawer, weird. I wasn't expecting Lil to bake us scones or break in to be our guest, but if she couldn't have been happy to see me, she might have been interested. Instead of acting like her estranged cousin's daughter is some Girl Scout selling charity magazine subscriptions to support underage monkeys or cure albinism. Jessa stands up from the table, which is my ticket to ride. But when I open my mouth, the one question I've wanted to ask all along bubbles out. Did she ever ask about me? Lil's whole face slides downward just a bit, but she clamps her jaw and tightens up. Last time we talked, she never said much about anyone but herself. I wish I knew what Lil was thinking. Sherlock Holmes would know. On the one hand, that guy is bug nuts. He's selfish, rude, and messy. He leaves beakers and pipettes and knives and poisoned shoe polish lying all around. Sometimes Watson wakes up to find Holmes watching him from the foot of the bed at 5 a.m., he solves a lot of mysteries after sulking on the couch in his sitting room for days. Confession? When I read A Study in Scarlet, the first book about Sherlock Holmes and his lifelong sidekick, Dr. John Watson, I paid particular attention to the scene where Watson walks in to find Holmes on his back, staring with dulled eyes at the ceiling of number 221B Baker Street. Dad did the same in the bad times.
a few of which I'd seen before we went to Lindy. And I thought maybe it was because that was how he figured out his mysteries. So Dad needed a little help sometimes. So what? Holmes needs Watson, and not just to fetch his shoes or write his biography. Watson brings him cases to solve when he's been sitting around for weeks shooting morphine and cocaine. Watson's the keeper of all the knowledge Holmes considers beneath him. Literature, philosophy, politics. He didn't even know the Earth revolved around the sun till Watson told him so, for God's sake. But flaws aside, Sherlock Holmes can read people like no other detective. He spent his whole life studying regular people instead of learning how to become a regular person. When he meets Watson, he knows the guy has been an army doctor in Afghanistan by the stiffness of his arm, the tan on his face, and the paleness of his wrists. I look at Lily and Eugene and try to read her life. Once she had a husband. Now she lives alone, and if she has co-workers or boyfriends or girlfriends over to visit, there sure isn't any evidence around her apartment. Lil didn't even have a second chair set out before Jessa and I came, and there are pictures of no one anywhere, unless you count a Garfield calendar tacked up by the wall flown. I think of how she sat on the kitchen floor with her babies, though it physically hurt her to do it, how her clothes were covered in their hair before they walked all over her, like she spends her whole life down there among them. I think of the bobblehead in her car, the Petco bag she lugs her school stuff and cleaning supplies around in, like she's got an endless hoard of them. The cats are absolutely everything to her, and she doesn't love them halfway. She loves them hard. Once Lil had a cousin, and they loved each other enough that even after they lost touch, she was my mother's emergency contact, the one person Mom trusted to come if she was called. Maybe Lil loved Sidonie Fay hard, that little girl drawing creatures in the tent in Fitchburg, the girl she shared her family with. Then Mom slipped away, called her once for money and never again, and Lil closed all that love up and put it away like a book on a shelf. So I come around after all this time, and she acts like we're strangers, even if we're connected by something as everything and nothing as blood. I almost wouldn't believe even that connection, except for Lil's chin, the tip of an aging heart. Okay. Thanks for your help, Lil. If I could tell you more, I would. But by the time she left your daddy, I didn't really know her anymore. A stray thought stops me in the doorway. Hey, did she ever say anything about marrying Dad? Whether they were, or were planning to, or anything? Lil looks surprised. I guess I always thought they had gotten married. Like I said, we weren't close at all. Not at that point. I was shocked she called me up when she left. But she did talk about getting married once. In the beginning, when she first came back. Sid said she could see herself happy, and if she and your daddy tied the knot, she wanted to do it on the same date they'd met. Their anniversary, kind of. She thought it'd be romantic, on account of the holiday. I told her sure, though secretly I thought that was strange, because that was the same day she went to claim Siobhan's body. And that day... was it Valentine's Day? Yes. 1995, that would have been. Lil blinks at me. Why? That day means something to you? 9. It's not that my dad is superstitious, but he does like to find the meaning in things. He claims it's because he tells stories, that it's the job of a writer, even writers of popular medical mysteries, to sift through random events and watch patterns emerge. Like finding constellations in a giant star-speckled sky. Maybe that's why he doesn't write during the bad times. He once said in a session with Lindy that things seem meaningless in the bad times, and how can he write if he can't find meaning? In the spring, at the very end of 7th grade, Dad and I were brainstorming a place for our 2-man family vacation. It was his idea, you survived middle school. Now gird your loins for high school adventure, he called it.
We were at the subway on East Main, in our traditional front corner booth farthest from the bathroom, eating our traditional spicy Italian on flatbread and chicken and bacon ranch melt, which we enjoyed at least twice weekly. Dad wasn't so much of a cook before Lindy came around. On the greasy skating rink table, there was an ad for Subway's new Santa Fe wrap. While we ate, Dad scribbled a list of possible places on the back of the ad. Niagara Falls, he said. The Grand Canyon, he said. Hawaii, I said, which he dutifully wrote down as Hawaii, parentheses, yeah, right. When our sandwiches were reduced to lettuce shreds, he tucked the ad in his jacket and we headed out. We then proceeded to the parking lot, where we had to squeeze our slightly fatter selves around a Hyundai Santa Fe that had parked too close to Dad's truck, forcing him to shovel me through the driver's side. As we backed out, Dad braked to stare at the back of the Hyundai, then plucked out the Subway ad, and with an alligator clip, he had me fish from the glove box, clamped it to his sun visor like a postcard. "What do you think, Jimmy? Santa Fe, New Mexico? Purple Mountains, the Rio Grande? Big sunsets, saloons, the Wild West?" I buckled in. "Because of a sandwich wrap? Because of a wrap and an SUV. The stars are aligned." "I don't know." But that night on TV, the Pirates game Dad had wanted to watch was canceled for rain, so we turned on the DVD player, having neglected it for months, and up came the last movie we'd left in the machine, Ace in the Hole. As you may or may not know, Ace in the Hole is an awesome, twisty 50s noir about this drunk, disgraced, big-city investigative journalist who has to go work for a crappy little paper in Albuquerque. Albuquerque, New Mexico. Dad tossed aside the extra butter popcorn we were splitting and our platter of ham roll-ups, our family recipe, like fruit roll-ups, almost as gummy, but made with prepackaged ham from the convenience store instead of fruit. He stood, spread his arms to the heavens, and shouted, "The stars are aligned!" And so that summer, we spent a week in Santa Fe. We hiked tent rocks and ate ice cream made to look like baked potatoes at the Cowgirl and shopped for cheap art at the street market in Old Santa Fe. On the last evening before our 10 a.m. flight home, while we perused the gift shop of our pink adobe motel for every kind of chili product available, from red chili jam to chili chocolate to chili-flavored soda, the cashier told us about this great isolated lake in the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. Though I was pretty sure we'd be captured by hill people, Dad was like, "Nah." So we set out in the late evening. It was dark and cool when we got to Santa Cruz Lake. Beyond the parking lot was a squat beach, and reaching out into the water, a long metal dock. We clanked over the walkway to the end of the dock and spread out a blanket. The water was dark and pretty deep. It lapped gently at the dock, maybe a foot below the platform. The hush, hush, hush of it, the only sound forever. We lay back and tilted our faces up into a million stars you could never see from the suburbs. Instead of the Sugarbrook sky, filmy and gray with streetlights and stadium lights and neon signs, the sky out there was huge and dusty with limitless solar systems. "See, Emmy," Dad said hoarsely, "the stars are aligned." The very next book Dad wrote was The Case of the Weeping Woman. The plot had Miles Fay traipsing out to Santa Fe to help a cousin accused of drowning his girlfriend in Santa Cruz Lake. Weeping Woman went big, his biggest novel yet, and in interviews he said he was inspired by the universe, New Mexico, and Subway. If we hadn't seen the ad for the Santa Fe wrap, if the Hyundai Santa Fe hadn't parked so obnoxiously that we paid particular attention to it, if a mass of air hadn't cooled to its saturation point, condensing water vapor into clouds that poured rain on a ball field in Pittsburgh, leaving us no choice but to turn on the DVD player and find Ace in the Hole. For Dad, there's some kind of mystical significance behind the ifs, playing one big cosmic game of connect the dots, not God or anything, meaning. Even when I was little and playing literal connect the dots in my coloring books, It kind of seemed like bullshit. Whatever blocky shapes emerged from my crayon, they never really looked like flowers or balloons or boats. Just jagged approximations in purple wax. What I'm thinking is, of course there was a Santa Fe wrap advertisement in our booth. We always chose that table because it was farthest from the bathroom. That meant it was closest to the front door, where every few minutes a customer would let in a blast of baking heat or biting cold, depending on the season, making it pretty undesirable to everyone but us. So whatever ads were plopped on the table before the breakfast shift likely stayed there past lunch. And duh, we passed a Hyundai Santa Fe on our way out. It is, after all, a top safety pick. And sure, Ace in the Hole was in the player. It's one of our favorites. We once went through a snap where we watched it 6 times in a month. There's a reason for everything, if you look hard enough. An answer for every mystery. If Dad met my mother on February 14th of 1995, the day he showed her the body of Siobhan Fay, and gave her a stone heart, as much a 20th anniversary as any for my I-now-know unmarried parents, then Lindy was wrong about Valentine's Day meaning nothing to Dad, especially if he and Mom had ever talked about marrying. That day meant everything to him, even when nothing else did. I know because even in the bad times, he told me my bedtime story. I'm on his trail. I felt it all along, and if I wasn't 100% positive he was off trying to save my mother, I am now. This is proof, actual and undeniable. What's more, I think he left the heart for me not as a clue, but as a map, hoping just this once I would see it too, the picture in the stars, and use it to find my way to him.
10. Why are you doing that with your face? Jessa winces at me while I lead us through the frosty parking garage.
Doing what? I'm smiling.
Yeah, but it's a crazy smile.
Like you're gonna pour me tea and make me a hat.
I just feel like I'm on the right path,
I say, breathless with the body slamming, finger burning cold, and with something else entirely. With this small balloon of excitement rising in my stomach.
And you think this because...
On the third level, I spot my Civic. We heave ourselves inside the car and I fumble to turn on the heat. How can I tell her about Valentine's Day and the lie of my parents' marriage and stone hearts? About the stars and the constellations? I can't, not even close. It's hard to explain.
Uh-huh. She sounds dubious, but I'm only half paying attention as I ask myself what I know. My mother grew up in Fitchburg. My mother was good at art. My mother was troubled waters, like her mother before her.
Hey, you want to, like, take a break tonight? Jessa asks. I mean, where are we going to go on a Sunday night anyway?
Just a little break. My parents are visiting my grandma, so the soccer team's coming over.
The soccer team she's talking about doesn't exist as an actual soccer team anymore. It's just a few guys from Chad's old team, the Sugarbrook Sandpipers, who went to Boston Colleges. They hang out in his basement bedroom with beer, the Wii U, and the secretive scent of weed drifting off them. Dad avoids social gatherings even in the best of times, and when I can't get out of them, I fulfill my very important duty of shoring up the wall. I fold my arms and cross my legs and try to find a cool position that communicates. I am perfectly happy, jammed in my corner, and have a lot of clever things to say, but there's no need to talk to me to make me prove it. When the glittering Times Square ball dropped on the big screen at the Price's New Year's Eve party last year, I was at the snack table with a pig in a blanket in my mouth, so it didn't look like I expected anyone, much less Chad Price, to make with midnight kisses.
Possibly. Jeremy's bringing Yingling just for me.
That's gallant. I hand Jessa the photos to hold, but flip through a few loose pages at the bottom of the pile. I unfold a brittle piece of butcher paper to find drawings in thick, dark pencil. As soon as I realize what they are, I tuck them into my coat pocket to pore over in private. This is a part of my mother I'm not ready to share. The other item in the pile is safer. An exhibition brochure for the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. It looks old, the paper fingerprinted and thin. I'm not sure why it's in the stack. Maybe a souvenir from when Mom worked there, until I skim the section on special exhibitions. There's a bit about a Masters of Fantasy show, the collected works of artists who explored the worlds of the imagination, the inner reality of the subconscious and of dream. Above the caption is a shot of the exhibit. "You're not listening to me, are you?" Jessa objects. Had she been talking? "Yeah, okay, whatever. But first, I need to see something." Lindy is out when I get home. I knew she would be. She left a message on my phone that she had errands to run and encouraged me to take a break from my marathon hangout with Jessa and stop home. Encouragement to the tune of, "Imogene Scott, if you aren't sitting across the kitchen table from me in the next 24 hours, you'll be eating every lunch for the entirety of February break in my office at work." Lindy's always given me my space, but I'm beginning to suspect she's losing patience. It's just as well she isn't here. It would feel wrong to walk unapologetically into Dad's office with my stepmother around. Settling into his rolling chair, I turn on his computer and reach into my bag while I wait for it to boot up. My knuckles scrape against the rough rind of the stone heart. But it's not what I'm after, and I dig deeper. I punch in the password, wondering if Dad meant it to represent Miles Fay or my mother. I make up my mind when the desktop brightens and floods with the familiar background. I never paid much attention to the picture. Each time I snuck onto Dad's computer, I was rushing against the clock. Now that I'm squinting at it with my face inches from the screen, I see the details of the painting. There aren't many. It looks like a watercolor and ink done in gray, and it's all pretty fluid. Black scrawls for clouds, a slightly grayer wash to separate the rain-scratched sky from steely seas. Men in flat-bottomed wooden boats haul up fishing nets, robes billowing in what must be a strong dark wind. Inside the scribble nets, the shapes of fish like small sea monsters. Pulling out the old Boston MFA brochure, I open it to the prints and drawings section and flatten it on top of Dad's desk calendar. There it is. The young woman examining a framed work of art on the wall, awe in her eyes. It's a gray picture of men in little wooden boats hauling up full to bursting fishing nets before the storm hits. The young woman in the picture is my mother. I have a stone heart, a scrappy backyard in Fitchburg where my mother used to draw monsters, a Western Union in Connecticut, a 20th anniversary, and now this. An inky sketch of fishermen. I don't know what it adds up to, but I know it leads somewhere. And how do I know that? Faith.